So I should start by thanking the organizers for organizing this conference and inviting me to this marvelous institute here.
I'm going to be talking about a certain approach to dealing with fundamental matter in various holographic theories. And it's going to be a compilation of results that have been derived, say, in the past year or so, well, even further back. And so it's something that I've worked on with a large cast of characters here, many of whom are in this room right now. And so this is definitely a report on a large joint effort. So here's an outline of the talk. I'm going to just introduce gauge gravity duality with fundamental fields. Then we're going to turn on the temperature and start thinking about what happens at finite temperature. And then we'll look at various, given our what we learn here about how fundamental matter behaves at finite temperature, we'll start studying various contributions they make to transport properties of the plasma. And then if we get there, there's one slide of conclusions and outputs. Okay, so this is where we're going to start. The standard AES-CFT is something that we derive from D3 brains in string theory, and so there's some kind of equivalence between a 10-dimensional superstring theory and a 4-dimensional gauge theory. And there's a dictionary between the two. There's here the TUF coupling, here I find the curvature of my gravity background, here I've got my gauge coupling, my string coupling. And in a particular limit where we can just work with supergravity, I'm taking small coupling, large TUF coupling, and so we're in the TUF limit there. One detail is that throughout this talk, I'm using a normalization that I inherited from string theorists. And so there's a factor of two, which I apologize, too lazy to go through and correct everywhere. But I don't think it's that important. The other obvious statement is that field theory is one that contains only fields in the adjoint representation of the gauge group. So how do we improve on that situation? Certainly in QCD, if that's our final goal, is got both fundamental and adjoint fields. Well, Karch and Katz came to the rescue several years ago, and they suggested that we enhance the usual ADS-CFT by adding not just the D3 brains we had before, but also some D7 brains. And so we do the same thing that Juan Maldacena did in deriving the ADS-CFT, but now we've got this extra set of brains. So what do? Well, we start in string theory over here with a bunch of brains. And so there's the big stack of D3 brains here and some D7 brains over here. And so there are closed strings wandering around everywhere, and then there are open strings, some supported on this stack of brains, some on these brains, some stretching between the two. But it's a result that if I go, this is sort of a perturbative description when I've got a weak string coupling. If I go to strong string coupling, this stack of D3 brains becomes very heavy and gains or produces a large gravitational footprint. And so a more efficient way to describe the system then is with a supergravity background that carries the properties of this stack of D3 brains, and I'm working in a limit where there's only a few D7 brains, and so there's still now some D7 brains sitting in that curved space geometry. The next thing we do is take a low energy limit. And so that affects us in several ways. One of the things it does is it decouples the asymptotic region. So the closed strings don't talk effectively to the brains anymore. And similarly here, the closed strings in the asymptotic region don't talk with the stuff in this so-called throat. So we get rid of that. If the energy is low enough, I can't excite sort of the stringy modes here. And so that reduces our brain theory, or what we've got here on the brains, down to a field theory. And so I represent that rather than extended strings, just with point-like strings, or a string that's just tightly stretched between those two. I'm going to scale, though, the distance or the separation between the brain in order to keep the mass of the lightest mode here in the spectrum of the theory. And so that's going to be the new stuff that's added on the field theory side. In this gauge theory, that's now a 7 plus 1 dimensional gauge theory, so the coupling there is dimensionful, and in this particular limit, the coupling goes to 0, i.e. nothing on this brain talks to this stuff anymore, and so we can get rid of that. And so what are we left with? Well, we're left with the usual field theory over here with some extra string or some extra modes that were inherited from these strings stretching out to the D7 brain. On this side, I've got just the throat, and there's this D7 brain sitting around in that curved space geometry. But the idea now is that if I take this field theory to strong coupling, I'm supposed to get here. And so this is another way, then, to describe the strong coupling limit of this particular field theory. So that's just the usual description of ABS-CFT, except we've got this extra element here and here. On the field theory side, what I've done is I've taken the usual super Yang mills and I've added a bunch of massive hypermultiplets. In doing so, I had to break the supersymmetry or reduce the supersymmetry down to an n equals 2 theory. And so I've got some extra scalars and fermions. But in particular, these now transform in the fundamental of that of the gauge group up here. And they also transform under a global symmetry that's the remnant of the gauge theory that lived on the 7th grade. There's also some internal symmetries, which I'll just briefly comment on here. So on the geometry side, what do I have? Well, this is a sketch of the geometry. Here I've got AES space. What we know about it is there's a bottom or a horizon down at small values of r. We're also terribly interested in large values of r, or the asymptotic boundary. But this is a 10-dimensional spacetime, so there is an internal space as well. So there's an S5 that's floating around at each point here in the ADS5. There's a gravitational potential as well, basically, that pushes everything down towards small values of r. I said there's a 7 brain, and it actually fills this entire space down to some minimum radius. The brain doesn't end there because it also has, you know, directions that are wrapping a 3 sphere in the internal space. But as I move down from the asymptotic boundary down to lower values, that 3 sphere starts as a maximal sphere up here. It sits on the equator of my internal space, and it starts to slip down towards the pole. And this place where the brain ends is actually the point where this reaches the pole. And so the brain is actually, in a 10-dimensional sense, smoothly closing off. The internal symmetry that we saw in the field theory becomes literally the internal symmetry in this geometric, internal geometric space. This theory, though, as we've seen many times before, there are strings that can hang down, and those are the representation, or how I represent the quarks in this particular geometric language. And so the energy of that string then corresponds to the mass of the quarks, or the mass of the fundamental fields in our field theory. I can also have bound states, i.e. I can have strings that have both ends supported on the D7 brain, and so those will be quark and quarks and bound states, and then, well, I'll use the language that those are the mesons of the theory there. So one of the things I want to emphasize, though, is that this really is a geometric description. There is no field theory here. It's not living at the boundary. But given these tools, what we have is a very precise dictionary on how to describe things in the field theory language. So for example, some of the calculations we saw last day related properties of the graviton in the bulk space with the stress energy tensor. Now I've also got excitations, say a gauge field on the D7 brain. Those are dual to operators involving the fundamental fields now. And so on the one level, I like to keep drawing pictures like that. But when I think of a quark, I have to think that in the space where the field theory lives, there's some object. And I can use the dictionary to describe that object. So this is a description of trace F squared, or the gauge field, around this quark with a finite mass. Similarly, I can draw nice pictures like that, as you saw in the tidal transparency. So this is the gauge field around a spinning meson. In any event, so we have this dictionary, and that's what we're going to work with. This, we're going to do gravity, but we're going to interpret it then in terms of the gauge theory. One technical detail is that I'm working, I said, in this limit where the number of D7 brains, or NF, the size of this global symmetry, was fixed or finite. And so we're in a limit where NF over NC is going to zero. So it's, well, often the language is that it's the quenched approximation. I really want to think, though, that I'm working in a literal sense with large N and large lambda, which means they're big numbers. And so this is a tiny number, but I don't want it actually to be zero. Because everything I'm calculating is going to be the first order correction in this expansion of NF over NC. If you, this is the set of calculations I'm doing today. If you want to work harder, one could go to large N with that ratio being fixed, but, or with the ratio remaining finite, but that's a much harder task, but there are some people who have made efforts in that direction. Okay, so I said that there are mesons in this theory, and I implied that those correspond to excitations of the D7 brain, and so there's an approach by which then we can just look at what are the excitations of the D7 brain. This is an action that describes the dynamics of the D7 brain. We can first solve for the embedding, or the fiducial geometry that the D7 brain has in this curved background. And then I look at fluctuations around that background, around that configuration of the D7 brain. I end up, at the end of the day, solving a radial equation that kind of looks like a Schrodinger equation with an effective potential like this. On this side, what that's saying is there's a gravitational potential that pushes us into the center of the space. This side is saying that the brain ends somewhere, and so that we can't go too far. But given a potential like that, we get a discrete spectrum that has this form, where the size, or the scale that characterizes the size of these masses is given by this ratio that involves this minimum radius of the brain and this size, which is the curvature scale of the ADS space. And so the smallest mass here, or what sets the mass gap then, is this quantity. And so this is actually interpreted, or becomes, when I translate it, the quark mass divided by the square root of the fifth quark. And so that's actually a scale that's very important, and it's going to appear over and over again in this talk. But its first role here is it sets the mass gap for the meson in theory. You can actually go further than just looking at fluctuations. You can expand to higher orders these fluctuations, and you can build an effective action for our mesons. And so here's the free part. This is the mass that I claimed that I calculated up there. But there are interactions, and you find that those interactions scale in a way that agrees with the usual lore for large N gauge theory. So that actually is my lightning review of gauge gravity duality with fundamental fields. And I hope that sets up the next few talks. But I'll pause there and ask if there are any questions.
You want quenched approximation, meaning that this D7 weight nothing compared to the big step, right?
But almost, yeah.
But they have so different dimensions. D7 is larger than D3. How it works?
Well, I gave you this geometric picture.
How would you know that the total mass of the cell is negligible compared to the total mass of?
Well, you, in some sense, I can do what was done. I know in the theory. Well, I had an action that action had a coupling to the graviton. So I know, if you like, how much the string theory thinks this brain weighs, and I can estimate, if you like, what the gravitational footprint of that object is.
So I guess.
And so in this limit, it's small.
You have this NFO and C is one number. Asking that your criteria has any other parameters or not. It's clear that you have NF over NC much smaller than going to zero.
Right.
I'm asking that the real criterion has some other parameters, or this is
it. It's actually, well, I think actually it's probably for this particular question, the relevant ratio is the relevant quantity of that particular ratio times the square root of lambda. We'll see that appearing later on, if you like. So yeah, you'll see an appearance of that, and if you do, you can remind me, and I'll comment on that. Okay, so what we've done so far is T equal zero temperature. Let's try going to turn on the temperature. Ed Witten taught us a while ago that ADS-CFT says that gauge theory thermodynamics I can think of as black hole thermodynamics in this ADS space. And so we replace the supersymmetric T3 brain throat, or this ADS-5, by a black hole geometry, an ADS black hole. There's a standard set of calculations that various people have developed that are useful. In particular, the Euclidean path integral is a simple way to get at the thermodynamics of the black hole. And so all we want to do now is extend this technology to include these probe brains, or to include the fundamental matter on the gauge theory side. But before we do that, let's think physically, what do we expect to happen? This is the configuration I described before. If I turn on a temperature, what I'm doing is I'm saying that there's some extra mass or some extra source of a gravitational field down here. The horizon actually pushes out into the ADS space, and it pulls down on the D7 brain. But if the D7 brain is far enough away, all it does is it sags a little bit. But it can still support itself. But if I continue cranking up the temperature, or cranking up the gravitational attraction of this black hole horizon, eventually what it does is it pulls the D7 brain through the horizon. And so there's two distinct kinds of configurations, and so we should expect to see some kind of phase transition in this system. And so this is just to repeat, we're going to go in this new direction, but we should expect to see something like a phase transition. There's a comment here, though, that what I'm talking about is not a deconfinement transition. As soon as I say that there's a black hole in the background, implicitly I'm talking about the gauge theory, or the adjoint degrees of freedom, being deconfined. And so this transition that I talked about here is something else. A reminder again about large N counting. There is a celebrated result of Steve Gupser, who I may have left already, is that the entropy density in the adjoint fields is given by this expression, and this nc squared appears here, counting the number of degrees of freedom in the adjoint field. What I have now is some extra fundamental matter, and so I expect to get a contribution to the entropy density that's going like the number of degrees of freedom here, which will now be nf times nc. However, what I said was that NF over NC is small, and so if I compare these two contributions, I'm going to get a very small number. And so I'm always going to be working in this talk in calculating the leading order contribution in an expansion in that small ratio.
Why is it not NF plus NC squared?
The total entropy. The total entropy is a sum of these two things. But all I said is I take the ratio of those two And it says that this contribution is much smaller than that. An extra comment is that there are other corrections that I should expect. For example, it was been commented in other talks that there's Hawking radiation in the background. But that should be an effect that's of order 1 over nc squared. And so this is a much larger contribution. Okay, well, this was actually studied a while ago by these folks. Joanna's actually, and Nick are in the audience. And they came up with a plot like this, where this is a quantity that I might think of as the quark condensate. So there's some curve like this. What they said is, well, maybe there's a third order phase transition, I think, in the, but that certainly that the work needed further refinement. Just staring at the paper, I always thought that it was over here. To his credit, the grad student in the collaboration, Ingo Kirsch, actually did that refinement. And in his thesis, you'll find that the transition is actually up here. There's some funny bending or back and forth in this quantity. And so what we're doing, or what we did last year, was a refinement on that.
Are we missing the square root of lambda there? What's the scale?
The square root of lambda. Yeah. Ignore the scale. So the way that I'm going to present the same, it is. The way I'm going to present the same data now, I mean, they had it in term, or, yeah, okay. So now this is the same graph. I'm presenting it in a different way. In this direction, what you have is the temperature over the quark mass. It's an informal theory, and so everything only depends on that particular ratio. In this direction, again, I've basically got this quantity that's related to this expectation value. On a broad scale, this is what you get. If I look closer at this region here, what I get is this bending that Ingo found. But if you look even closer between those two sets of configurations, if you look there, what you find is that the curves turn around yet again. If you look closer, they turn around yet again. And so there seems to be this spiraling. But actually, this transparency needs some explanation. There are all sorts of words here: black hole embedding, Minkowski embedding, critical solution. So I have to take a step back for a second. So the Minkowski embedding is a name that we gave to these configurations that are sagging but not touching the horizon. And the black hole embeddings are the ones that fall through the horizon. The induced metric on that object is actually a black hole, or contains an event horizon. Hence the name. But in between the two, there's actually something called the critical embedding, where it sags down and just touches the horizon. And so it's an intermediate configuration. And what one finds is that you can work analytically around this particular critical embedding, and you find some interesting self-similar behavior that predicts an infinite set of spirals in various physical quantities as you approach this critical embedding from either side. And we actually were just borrowing technology that had been developed by Valerie Frolov in another context, talking about asymptotically flat black holes. But I'm not going to go into the details there. I'm just going to say that the physical properties of the system are multi-valued. That's what we found. And so what we have to do is find the true ground state, or the true physical configuration, using thermodynamic considerations. So what we do is we calculate the free energy. And look, here are the black hole embeddings coming down in the dotted line. This is the Minkowski embeddings, black hole embeddings, the two cross right here. And so there's a phase transition. All that interesting spiraling essentially gets reduced down to a dot over here. And so that's not really terribly relevant for the physics of this particular system. But it is important that, because of the multi-valuedness that this produced, I had to get this first order phase transition. And it really is a first order phase transition. If I look, say, at the brain entropy, I'm coming up in temperature, and there's a jump then as I come from this Minkowski phase
up to the black hole phase, and then I continue there.
Is this kind of expensive?
And it's the entropy density.
Yes.
Yeah. If I ask what is the temperature, well, I mean, there's some scale here, but basically that temperature is, again, the quark mass divided by the square root of lambda. So that scale comes into the problem again, setting the scale for the phase transition. It was commented that, you know, the total entropy should be the sum of the two contributions. So here's the usual bulk result. Here's our result. Here's the NF over NC, but here's that extra factor of lambda that I commented on before. Essentially, what we're doing is we're calculating the first order back reaction in due to the D7 brain. And so what really controls that back reaction is this ratio times lambda. And I got the square root wrong before. But that's then an enhancement over the naive counting that I gave before. And there's this function here that I only know numerically. But it takes a form there. The phase transition is just a little glitch down there. Yeah, zero temperature over here.
So for this to be a valid expansion, you need NF over NC small or lambda times NF over NC small?
No, I need that.
The whole thing to be
yeah.
So that's lambda squared in the whole.
What's lambda squared?
In the whole. Oh.
Or there are lots of other corrections.
No, but is it lambda or lambda squared?
I guess, no, okay, the next term here would be a lambda squared. Yeah. Okay, so we've got this new system. We talked about mesons before. We can talk now about the effects that the temperature has on our meson spectrum. This is zero temperature. There was some spacing there. There was also some degeneracy that only depended on the sum of certain quantum numbers. If I turn on the temperature, in general, all of the masses start going down. This degeneracy is broken. And the phase transition is over here. But it's some finite decrease, I guess, before I hit phase transition. This is the rest mass. For a set of pseudo-scalar excitations, mesons. There was some discussion of mesons in motion the other day, so I'll just whip through this. The only extra comment I wanted to make here is that here I have something I call a radial profile, but it's something I might think of as a parton distribution. And so even though all I gave you was a mass, the duality is actually giving you a lot of information about the structure of these mesons, of these objects, that I don't think we fully exploited yet. There's also a comment about stability. I showed you this curve before. Stability is going to require the slope to be positive, but clearly it's not positive everywhere. And so I should expect to find instabilities in the system. And this is the Minkowski branch. And so, in fact, I can find an instability in a certain set of mesons, in a certain channel in the meson spectrum. What happens is that this is a scalar meson spectrum, and I'm coming down here very close. Actually, I've gone past the phase transition. I'm in some super cooled phase. This place where all the curves turn around is the first loop in that diagram there. And one of the things you'll note is that one of the mass squares goes through zero here. And so one of the modes actually becomes a tachyon. If you follow it further, you actually find that each time I get a curve in the spiral, I get a new tachyonic mode appearing in the. So this thermodynamic instability actually corresponds to this dynamical instability here. What is the most striking feature of this phase transition? Well, it's actually in the spectrum of the theory. The mesons on the Minkowski branch were stable particles, so there's a discrete spectrum. The precise positions of the states has changed, but it's still this discrete spectrum of stable states.
On the black hole side, I've got excitations in essentially a black hole geometry. And so the spectrum is continuous and gapless. What does that have to do, or what can I extract from that? Well, this is actually a property that holds for a large number of holographic theories. And in particular, in some theories where there's a confining phase transition, or there's confinement, one can find two sets of phase transitions, one for the deconfinement and one for this melting of the mesons. Is this a feature of QCD? Well, I'm pessimistic and running out of time, so I won't comment further. One of the things I wanted to portray, though, is that this is not all exotic physics. There's some simple physical principles in action here. This is a reference that many people will know, and you'll know that they weren't talking about exotic mesons in an N equals 2 theory, but the same idea still applies here. If we look at structure, or if these folks looked at the structure functions, they said there's a size associated with these mesons. Looking at the Wilson lines also tells us there's a screening length, and so we expect the mesons to dissociate when the screening length gets down to about the size of the mesons. And what does that tell us? Well, there should be a melting or a dissociation when the temperature is about this scale. And I got that wrong, because there's a square root in there. I apologize. There really is a square root in there. Okay. Transport properties. There's stuff you can do, but we don't really have time, or I don't have time. I'll talk about one thing, which is diffusion, but now for something that I'm going to call light quarks. And so there are conserved currents associated with these fundamental fields. And I expect the charge associated with those currents to diffuse via Fick's law. And so there's some constant that characterizes how quickly it diffuses. There are a number of ways in which you can calculate that constant. In fact, we calculated them all three ways, and you always get the same answer. It's something like this. So at very large temperatures, the diffusion constant saturates like this, 1 over 2 pi t. As I'm coming down towards the phase transition, it doesn't change much, but then it dramatically drops down here. If I zoom in on that region of the graph, what I see is that the curve actually starts to wave back and forth, but that's just because of this spiraling. There's more than one configuration corresponding to each of these temperatures. Of course, the phase transition is here, and so all of that stuff gets thrown away. But if I have 1 minute, let's try and put this in a big picture. I'm going to present this now on this axis, 2 pi times the temperature times my diffusion constant. On this axis, I'm actually going to present it as the coupling, lambda. So this is the curve for a particular ratio of quark to temperature, 200. This is the curve that I showed you on the last transparency. This line here is where it cuts off at the phase transition. We heard about, in other talks this week, about the result for heavy quarks. So those were strings hanging down from the Minkowski phase. And so there's a result which, with my choice of lambda, looks like this. That gives us a nice straight line. Some other gentlemen actually did some perturbative calculations with this theory, and so there's another line that comes down out of here. And so, well, I've got these lines, I have to join them up. There you go. So this is the phenomenology of our theory. This is an artistic impression. I had to get from here to here, so they must have crossed. Well, I'll restrain from saying anything about cosmology. But this is a phase transition. I get to a certain large coupling. I've chosen that ratio, so it's just shy of 100,000. That sounds like a large number to me. And then it jumps from one curve up to the light, well, what I'm calling now the light quark curve, and then continues out here. So it's one should keep in mind, the ratio of the quark mass to the temperature is always 200, but I'm actually getting a phase transition here because there is this other scale in the problem. Now, that may not seem very interesting to people. I mean, this particular ratio isn't a ratio that's relevant in, say, RIC or even LHC. So I might stick in some other curves corresponding to other ratios that might seem phenomenologically more interesting. And all that happens is that this curve slides over to the left. Keep in mind, though, that we did these calculations in, or we're confident of those calculations when lambda is large. There are going to be big corrections to those results over here. Now, of course, I've restrained from comparing to QCD so far, but where would RIC be? Well, I'd be looking at parameters that look like that. So that's choosing alpha S equals 0.5 and picking some random numbers off of a graph for this quantity that the STAR, well, I saw the graph up here, the STAR collaboration fit and so there it is. It's sitting here, but I guess the one thing I would take away is it's definitely not in a regime where I'm going to see some dramatic phase transition like this. One might also start to worry that we're also, you know, getting away from a regime where the heavy quark formula applies as well. Steve suggests that we move this around a little bit in various ways, but I would take it as a, well, I would look at that and think hard about what you're going to do. And so I'm, well, there, yeah, there's Steve moving it around. I've run out of time, and so there's a last transparency, and there are three more talks to come this afternoon, so stay tuned.
So in the penultimate part of your talk, when you were talking about meson melting, and then you said, what about QCD? You said, I'm pessimistic. Why are you pessimistic given that all the caveats we heard this morning, but the evidence from last QCD is that J psi survived for around 2 TC.
Yeah.
And upsilon, wasn't talking about it, upsilon survived for around 3 or 4 TC.
Yeah.
And the logic of that is exactly the logic of what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And there's a melting transition temperature which goes up with the meson mass just as the meson size goes down.
Sure. Because I think that what you can get are qualitative features like that.
Sure.
You know, what you're saying is there's this phase transition.
No, I didn't say phase transition.
Okay, there's deconfined glue, there are bound states.
There are dissociation transitions.
Right, okay. However, the detailed physics of J psi and these mesons here is completely different.
Sure.
It's very, very different. And so if you're careful, you might be able to extract something out of it.
Yeah, okay.
But if you just go ahead naively and say, well, here are my mesons, this is the temperature.
So you missed Hong's talk, everyone else heard it. Hong showed something qualitative that you might try and get out of it. But
this is still not a phase transition.
Of course it's not.
No.
Of course that's a phase transition. That's a big difference.
That's characteristic of these holographic theories. I mean, for example, the crossover that we heard about is typically first order phase transition.
The sense in which I think the two theories are very different that matters is that in QCD, the J psi melts at 2 TC, but its first excited state melts at a much lower temperature, 1.2 TC. Whereas in this theory, because the mesons are so tightly bound, the ground state and all the excited states that you have control over all melt at the same temperature.
If I got to talk about the spectral functions, I think it's slightly more subtle than that. But I would just say, though, that, you know, well, I would just reiterate that, you know, I know how a J, you know, I know, you know all sorts of physics about the J psi, and you know that because, you know, the strong coupling has run, and you can do things perturbatively, and there's a hydrogen-like spectrum. what you're dealing with here is a practically conformal theory, and it doesn't run, and that's why this new scale is an important scale in the theory, and there's nothing like that. Anyway, we tried to slice it.
And what proved lambda being a new scale?
Square root of lambda,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, that's the same thing I just said.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and so, well, yeah, okay. I mean, I'd be happy to talk more with you, but.
I think we just said the same thing.
Okay. Okay.
You're willing to wait for the questions.